Hello, Josh Tyson, UX Magazine. Had a really good conversation the other day with Joe Natoli. He's a UX consultant. He's been in the game for about 26 years. He's worked with all sorts of big companies, big organizations, kind of specializes in enterprise experience design. Got a lot of lessons that he wants to share with the community, and he's put them into a new book called Think First, My No-Nonsense Approach to Creating Successful Products, Memorable User Experiences, and Happy Customers. That book comes out on October 5th, so this is kind of a heads up to y'all. We had a great talk. We talked about unicorns. We talked about the changing nature of experience design. We talk about hairdressers. Imagine that. Hairdressers are masters of empathy, in case you didn't know. We also talk about the merger last year of Adaptive Path and Capital One. For the life of me, I couldn't arrive at Capital One. I had Bank One, Chase. Neither of those are correct. We were talking about the Adaptive Path Capital One merger. But flub aside, great conversation. So let's get right to it. Okay. So Joe Natoli, am I saying that right?
Yes, you are.
Okay, good. I always like to check that first. I'm pretty iffy on pronunciations of certain words, so.
No worries.
Just to keep it clean, you know? So we're here in part to discuss your new book, which is called Think First.
Yes, sir.
But I think maybe the best way to get there might just be to talk about how you got into UX, because what I like about this book is that, you know, there are lots of books that tell you how to do very specific, granular things. But this book is to me, kind of reflects the inclusive spirit of true experience design, which is that kind of anyone can take part. You just have to kind of know what you're getting into and what to bring, yeah. What tools to bring.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the story behind that, and the reason the book is the way it is, goes all the way back to my days in design school, to be honest. I mean, I'm fond of saying that it, at one period in time, okay, we didn't call this user experience design or people weren't even talking about usability. We just called it design. Okay, I came into graphic design at a time when you still did things by hand. You were cutting overlays for print ads. You were measuring typography to see how many characters would fit in a given space. You know, computers weren't introduced until I was pretty much at the tail end of my college career. But I was really lucky in that I attended Kent State University, and the way design was taught in that program was that it was about a lot more than simply understanding the principles, basic principles of design. You know, what makes elements on the page or in a layout harmonize. You know, what dictates good typography or good imagery. It was more about how do people receive what you're putting out, right? What you design, is it communicating to them? Is it speaking to their expectation, to their understanding? Is it properly motivating them to do something? Is their focus being led around the design in a very purposeful way? So in a lot of ways, to me, all the fundamental principles that I learned in the 4 years that I was there is the exact same foundation of what I do now. You know, so to me, it's never been just one thing. It's design is design is design is design. And I'm of the belief that, like Massimo Vignelli, a famous print designer, said, if you can design one thing well, you can design anything well.
You know? And that kind of speaks to, yeah, looking at design as more of a process than a set of tools or a specific way of doing things. It's like it's a process that you can apply to a problem.
Right. And again, the way it was hammered into us and what I personally believe is that it's first and foremost a problem-solving discipline. And that's really what you're doing. One way or another, you're solving communication problems. Now, with interaction, mm-hmm. you have a whole new set of things to consider, of course. But yeah, design to me, in the true sense of the term, is problem-solving. If you're not problem-solving, you're decorating.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too. You think of maybe someone looking at a poorly designed advertisement or something someone's trying to communicate something with a visual design and someone's looking at it and it's not hitting them the way that the designer intended. And maybe that person doesn't can't articulate like really why it's bad or why it's not working for them. But as you move into experience design, maybe it becomes a little more easy for lay people to weigh in on why it's bad, because it's this whole experience, and if it's not working, it's pretty obvious that it's not working.
Yeah, I think there's a cognitive dimension that happens in you know digital interaction design that isn't present, you know, when you're absorbing a print ad or even a one-way medium, right, like television or radio or the printed page. There's no cognitive aspect. When you're interacting with something on the screen, you know, your brain is telling you, like, I get that, I understand it, I know what to do next, or this is confusing, I have no idea what I just did, I don't know where I am, I don't know where to go next. You know, that's missing from the sort of one-way mediums.
And was the kind of fussiness that goes into really creating a spot-on visual design, a piece of visual design, did that lend itself well, in a sense, to experience design, or to the way that you approach experience design, or is it something that you kind of had to recalibrate a little bit?
Quite honestly, it's the former. It absolutely lends itself to good experience design, because that obsession over the details, you know, the quote about, you know, God being in the details, that's the same thing. Because a lot of times when we see a UX failure, right, I spend a lot of time with enterprise organizations in particular, when you see a UX failure where either, you know, people are having trouble with something or the end result isn't what anybody wanted or any number of things, it's almost never one big staggering thing. It's more like death by a thousand cuts. It's a little tiny details, right? Where a button is placed or the length of a field or one word in a label that throws off the person's, you know, context for what it is that they're doing. It's always those little tiny obsessive things that nobody pays any attention to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting too, because conversely, like a really, it seems these days especially, a really well-designed experience looks quite minimalistic usually. You know, the cognitive load is light.
Yeah.
But what people aren't seeing, and I guess where that fussiness comes in is, like you said, it's behind the scenes a little bit. It's like knowing exactly where to put your call to action. So it's a call to action and not just clutter.
Right. I mean, distraction. You know, it's a color detail. You can have a button that's gigantic, right? And there's lots of white space around it, lots of negative space, and it sits alone and it's in technically within the user's field of vision, and they miss it, right? So you dig into that and you say, all right, well, why are they missing it? And if you watch people, you know, what you find out is that because of the color that's being used or because of some other element on the screen that's maybe up in the top left or top right corner, they're being pulled away from it, right? Their focal point is somewhere else for some other reason. So a lot of times I think decisions get made and they say, okay, we'll just make this bigger, right? We'll make it bolder. We'll make the font larger, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times that can have the opposite effect. You know, bigger isn't always the answer. It's about contrast. It's about proximity, similarity, you know, being able to chunk things on the screen and understand that, okay, this goes with this stuff, this goes with this stuff. And it's often really subtle things. It doesn't take much to throw somebody off the path.
And what brought you to design initially? Was it just, were you always kind of interested in visual arts growing up?
Yeah, I had been drawing pictures essentially since I was, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6. I think since I was old enough to hold a pen. And I grew up in a very small town in Ohio. And a career in the arts wasn't something that people sort of readily understood, to sure. be honest with you. And my high school guidance counselor, for example, when I told him, you know, my junior or senior year, I wanted to do something art related, you know, with my life, he essentially suggested that I join the Army. That was his answer for me.
There you go. Whip this kid into shape.
Yeah, so I was lucky in that my high school art teacher was an incredible, incredible guy named Sam Fachibin. And he sort of saw that I had a thing for visuals and text, because everything I did in his class always included hand-drawn text as well. And he took me aside one day and he said, I think you should consider this field of study called graphic design, right? I knew nothing about it. Read a few things about it in the college catalogs and thought, okay, maybe this is it. So I had no idea, you know, when I went off to school. I got extraordinarily lucky again. Okay, if lightning strikes twice, this definitely happened to me. The very first day of class, a woman by the name of Katie Kennedy taught my visual organization principles one class. Mm-hmm. And I was hooked instantly, right? I was just hooked. Everything she said was like, you know, the word down from the mountain.
Yeah, that is lightning striking. And your first day of college and you already know what you want to do.
Yeah, I got so lucky. I can't even explain how fortunate that is, because I was clueless before that.
Well, in a career in the arts too, I mean, you said growing up in Ohio, that was an unusual goal to have. But I think even if you grew up in Manhattan or in New York, you know, someplace cosmopolitan where there are more artists around, I mean, forging a viable career in the arts is extremely tricky thing to do.
Certainly.
My wife is a hairstylist, and I tell her that all the time. I mean, and it's a crazy environment too, because a salon is just a big pressure cooker of all these really artistic people working together who have different, wildly different aesthetics.
Yeah, a lot of independent competition, I would imagine.
Yeah, but I always point out to her, like, I mean, you, and I think she knows too, just how fortunate she is that she's a very creative person who has. Who found a really good way to make a really nice living doing precisely what she wants to do, something like very creative. And she gets that satisfaction on an hourly or bi-hourly basis as she's cutting and coloring hair.
See, and that's actually, no, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I think that's actually a really good analogy, because in both design of any kind and, you know, you're talking about hairstyling, you know, what you can do with your hands, the physical part is certainly part of that. But the part that makes you rise above, the part that enables success, the part that allows you to have some longevity, right, in what you're doing and have what you do be valuable to people, is what's between your ears.
Absolutely.
You know?
Well, and interestingly enough, I feel like a common theme that we touch on in the magazine and just in conversations that I have with practitioners is that maybe not a high enough premium is always placed on communication skills. So
yeah.
One of the reasons, I mean, my wife's really, really skilled cutter and colorist, but she's also really good at talking to people, and her clients will frequently tell her things that they say, you know, I haven't even told my therapist this, but like they feel very open with her and they leave, you know, looking different and then also maybe feeling different because she's listen to them, like truly listen and give them good advice. And I think a big part of experience design is that it's like this ability to kind of listen. And I mean, she has to turn off the noise in her head and step out of herself and just really listen. Yeah. And I think that skill set is definitely one that is valuable just to have at the design table. But also if it's a skill that comes packaged in a UX designer, then bonus points.
Totally agree. Totally agree. I mean, it's empathy and context, right? Just like in a client situation, the only way, again, the only way that what you're saying or the advice that you're giving them or what you're suggesting needs to happen, the only way that's valuable is if they feel like you truly understand what their problem is, right? Number one. And then number two, if you're speaking to it in context, you know, if you're talking about fonts and colors and design principles, you've lost them. If you're talking about the fact that 50% of the people that hit this screen abandon it and call the help desk, right, and you talk to them about the reasons that is happening or could be happening and how you find out how to solve that problem, well, now you've got their attention.
Yeah, so crucial.
And I think a lot of and I think it's maybe because they're not always explicitly taught. A lot of designers often don't speak that the sort of empathetic language of clients, of business.
Yeah, and I think in a business setting too, there's kind of this knee-jerk reaction to want to dazzle people with your expertise a little bit when really, I mean, a situation like that is calling for you to just be able to identify their needs, to see where their product is falling short and to help them fix it. Like they don't really need to know, you know, that you know exactly what font will draw in the most users or get the highest conversion rate. You know, they want to know something a little more, maybe not universal, but kind of more basic.
Yeah, human. I think that's right. I mean, and early on in your career, I think you fight that a little bit more because you're sort of so excited to be in the room, especially if it happens to be a large client, you know, you want to impress them. you want them to feel like this guy knows what he's talking about, right? So you sort of want to start throwing out things immediately, but the more important skill, and I talk about this in the book, the actual the skill that has more value is the ability to really listen and internalize what they're telling you.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I often think that I came to UX from a print journalism background, if we go all the way back.
Perfect.
And I often think about, like, if I was transitioning into, like, a design atmosphere or something, like, how would I present my, like, would I have that impulse to, like, want to, like, just kind of distract them with data and stats? And even though I've had more experience in UX, I feel like my wife would actually have an easier time going into a client meeting and just totally sussing out client needs and have them feel cared for. So maybe that's my prescription. Bring in a really good hairdresser.
That's, you know, that sounds like one of those articles that you see a lot of these days. What hairdressing can teach us about user experience?
Yeah, I'm surprised. Jeez, I'm surprised I haven't published that one yet.
It's yours, man. Write it.
I'm going to run with it.
Go do it right now.
I've got some in-house help. So, yeah, but I mean, and I think that's another, I mean, that speaks to the point that, that what I've really liked about UX, and, you know, I was nervous coming into it because I knew very little about it, but I think you bring your own perspective, you bring your own experience, you bring your own skills, and you can kind of find a way to make sense in this world and to be valuable. And I don't think everything's even been discovered yet, in a sense. Like, no. We have the roles are carved out, like the most crucial roles, but there's kind of ways to straddle roles or to even just fill a smaller part of a single role and just do it really well. Like, there's just so much opportunity if you're willing to kind of flex with it and grow a little bit and kind of admit that you don't always know what you're doing and just being open to learning about it at every turn.
Yeah, be willing to be wrong. And that, I mean, that's one of my favorite things, you know. you absolutely have to be willing to be wrong, because it's the only way you'll investigate to the degree that you need to. You know, when I work with teams in particular, it's the roles that are in the room. All right, I do a lot of training for organizations, teams, and we have everybody from business analysts to the product owners themselves to designers to developers to QA people.